pretend to show success.
For all, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, brought to you proudly by GorillaMedia.co.nz, New Zealand's unconventional news. Now, speaking of New Zealand and being rather unconventional, we have a very special guest for you, ladies and gentlemen, joining us from Kafka in Christchurch. His name is Murray Horton. And those of you in the world who are currently under free trade partnerships, which basically enslave your country quicker than anybody could ever conceive of, you'll probably understand what he's talking about. Murray, welcome to the program.
How are you, Vinny? Thank you for having me on.
Oh, mate, it's an absolute pleasure because, well, basically the difficulty is, Murray, all of our nations are getting sold out pretty well and incrementally by our own governments and all doing these little crazy treaty airs type thingies. But we'll get into that after this first short segment. I was more interested in you yourself, Murray, and how you got involved with Kafka and what it actually is, for that matter.
Okay, well, Kafka, C-A-F-C-A, stands for Campaign Against Foreign Control of Aotearoa. Now, you're broadcasting to an American audience, is that right, Vinny?
An American, New Zealand, and Norwegian, not to mention about 88 different countries around the world.
Who don't recognise the last name, Aotearoa. Aotearoa is the indigenous Maori name for New Zealand, and it means land of the long white cloud. Although I'm pleased to say today, certainly at this end of the country, it's the land of the clear blue sky and lovely sunshine. So that's the name of our organisation, Kafka, not to be confused with Franz Kafka, the author. And we've been going for between 35 and 40 years now. I personally date back to the protest movement against things like the Vietnam War, etc., at the end of the 1960s and into the 70s. Kafka as an organisation grew out of that milieu.
Okay. And well, how exactly, when was our first free trade deal? I mean, I know that the World Trade Organization has been working rather well at getting countries to buy into these things, and then they basically subsequently get all their assets either shut down or offshored to the detriment of the people who still live in the country. But what's the real source of this? I mean, what pressure is being put on governments in order to implement these basically nation-destroying policies?
The one that I know that goes back the furthest in New Zealand is CER, Closer Economic Relations with Australia, which actually goes back to 1983. And CER is sort of part of the wallpaper and the relationship between New Zealand and Australia, and it's regularly liberalised and updated, etc. With a few exceptions, it establishes a common market between New Zealand and Australia. And as recently as, in fact, I think right now, the Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard is visiting New Zealand today. And I think they're signing an investment agreement between the two countries, which means that Australian firms investing in New Zealand, which are they're the biggest single source of foreign investment in New Zealand, not surprisingly, seeing their closest neighbour, get a much more privileged position than firms from other countries. Just to explain briefly the law.
Our very special guest, ladies and gentlemen, Murray Horton, coming at us from Kafka in Christchurch, New Zealand, the Campaign Against Foreign Control of Aotearoa, the land of the long white cloud, where we broadcast from live every day. And we'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
Yeah, and no one like me. Yeah. Congratulations, you made it. Welcome to the Crusader. It's been a long time coming, yo. But I'm here now. So what you wanna do? How many dudes you really know can flow? Like this, let's do it.
How many dudes you know vote like this? How many dudes you know flow like this?
Not many, if any. Not many, if any.
How many dudes you know got the skills to go and rock a show like this? I don't know anybody.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally, TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com. We're broadcasting live from the future on Rush 89 FM in Hamilton, the Tron, the city of the future, the city of Agenda 21. Welcome back. Also, to our very, very special guest, who I'm delighted to bring on with us for a whole hour today, Murray Horton from CAFCA, the Campaign Against Foreign Ownership of New Zealand. Murray, welcome back.
Vinny, what we were saying before the break was you asked when do these free trade agreements date back to. I suppose they got serious in the 80s and into the 90s. There was an organization, you're familiar with the World Trade Organization, the WTO. The predecessor of that was called GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, and there was a thing called the Uruguay Round, which was the name of a round of negotiations on agriculture, and that went through and was concluded in the 1990s, 94, 95 from memory. GATT was replaced by the WTO, and they launched a series of negotiations trying to get a sort of overarching free trade agreement to sort of bind the sort of the world together into these sort of agreements in the interests of big business. And it's worth noting, of course, that these free trade agreements also always carry with them embedded investment agreements. And so probably this thing reached its pinnacle round about the turn of the century when we had New Zealand and Christchurch's very own Mike Moore, not to be confused with Michael Moore, the filmmaker. Mike Moore was, of course, for a while there, a few years, the Director General of the World Trade Organization. Now, right now, he is the New Zealand Ambassador to the United States. So the WTO, but it got bogged down. It's trying to resolve a thing called the Doha Round, named after the capital of Qatar, in the Middle East, and what they can't agree on is agriculture, among other things. So the WTO is bogged down, so what's happened is the governments of the world have tried to go for a series of what are called bilateral, i.e. two countries, or multilateral, several country trade agreements. A bilateral agreement, an example, is what I was talking about before the break.
So the shorthand is they couldn't scam the whole world at one time, so they decided
they
to scam
do it
individually.
In one hit. They tried in the 90s with a thing called the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, or the MAI, which was an attempt to actually establish a binding investment, not trade, investment treaty that would give corporations the right to sue and would give corporations the same legal standing as governments. They tried to do that, and that was the subject of a very major campaign, both here in New Zealand and also internationally, and it was defeated both here in New Zealand and internationally. That was an attempt to do in sort of one king hit to establish sort of global corporate rule, and it failed. And so what's happening now, the New Zealand government and the other countries around the world have been going for something a little less grandiose. In America, for example, they have NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, which is the US, Canada and Mexico, and has some salutary lessons for New Zealand in that. Most countries have been going for these, as I say, bilateral or multilateral with a number of other countries, trade agreements. And the one that we're concerned about, our organization concerned about right now, is what's called the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. And this is an attempt to, it's being negotiated right now. I mean, literally this week, there is a round of negotiations taking place in Chile. This involves New Zealand, the United States, and seven other countries, total of nine, trying to sort of sign a trade agreement, which would include an investment agreement.
Let's hope some emails get leaked about that, and they'll call them the Ninth Gate emails.
Or something like that. Yes, exactly. The timetable of the negotiators is to have it signed in Obama's home state of Hawaii. I think it's November this year, 2011, when the United States hosts the annual summit of APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, it's called. I'm sure your listeners have heard of APEC, and the idea is to have this treaty ready to be signed then. What's happened, I mean, the history of this very briefly, there was a thing called the P4. P stood for Pacific. Pacific 4, existing treaty between, a rather obscure one, between New Zealand, Chile, Brunei, and Singapore, a rather unlikely group. But anyway, there was an existing free trade agreement between those four countries. And then under the previous Labor government here in 08, it was announced in the final months of that government that that would be expanded to include the United States. And the effect of that would be to actually bring about a free trade agreement between New Zealand and the United States, and sort of done by the back door. Both both major political parties in this country, both National and Labor.
What a free trade deal actually is. I mean, my understanding is it's more or less an economic Trojan horse, basically, where foreign corporations suddenly get the rights of a human being, and then they can actually come in, operate business, and do it in a very corrupt and terrible way. And if the government of the day decides to say, hey, look, you guys are operating really, really unfairly in our country, we're going to kick you out, or we're going to stop you from trading, or we're going to do or take any number of measures through the courts, through to legislation or whatever, basically they're immune from any type of justice.
I mean, the free trade agreement with an embedded investment clause or embedded investment agreement basically gives corporations from that originating from that country that signed the treaty sort of special rights in the country. And so if there's a free trade agreement with the United States via this TPPPA, Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, that means that American corporations get a protected position here, and they would also have the right to take legal action against the New Zealand government if they feel that they've been discriminated against. John Key initially denied this, and the New Zealand Prime Minister initially denied that this would be in fact the case, but very recently, within the last week or so, one of the American negotiators has in fact put the position straight that New Zealand does accept, the New Zealand government does accept that American corporations and corporations from the other countries signing that treaty would have the right to take legal action and would have legal standing to do so.
Well, I guess we could just add that to the list of stuff that John Key said that hasn't panned out.
Exactly. I mean, if this treaty goes ahead, we can expect a further attack on what's left of foreign investment protections in this country. There aren't many. The United States has made very clear, for example, that it sees the existence of PharmAc, the government body in this country that regulates and sets the price that New Zealanders pay for prescription drugs. The U.S. sees PharmAc as being an impediment to the business of U.S. Drug companies and wants it gone. So therefore, they want to impose the American prescription drug model on New Zealand, and your American listeners won't need to be told what that means. That's why Americans cross Canada, the Canadian border, in droves to get cheap drugs over the border in Canada. It has implications for things like intellectual property rights. It has implications for things like
New Zealand's law and continuity. Likely to commit suicide and have many other disorders that are worse than whatever condition they were taking the drugs to help with.
Well, something like that, exactly. The U.S. makes very clear that its position is one of, the U.S. government makes clear that its position is one of pushing at all times very aggressively the interests of American big business. And this was made plain in the some of the cables, the diplomatic cables that were leaked by WikiLeaks late in 2010 and earlier this year, most of them related to military and intelligence aspects of the relationship with New Zealand, but some of them did directly relate to this Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement and what the United States sees as quote-unquote impediments to its the ability of its corporations, its transnational corporations, to do business in this country. So, the last Labor government signed up a free trade agreement with China in 2008, and that has already led to an upsurge of Chinese corporations coming into this country, Chinese agribusiness in particular, buying up New Zealand farms, New Zealand agribusinesses, etc., and there's been a whole backlash in public opinion, and indeed within the ruling party in this country, on this very subject. And when you'd be aware, your listeners will be aware, there was the attempt by a Chinese corporation to buy the bankrupt empire of the Crater Farms, dairy farms in this country, and the Federated Farmers, which is the organisation of farmers in New Zealand, put out a press release saying this was an unintended consequence of the free trade agreement with China. Well, in actual fact, there's nothing unintended about that consequence at all. This is the way that free trade agreements operate. They provide a platform for corporations, businesses, firms, etc., from the country signing the treaty to sort of come in and operate with all legal protections and, in fact, have a privileged position. So we can, we've already seen a sort of a push by sort of Chinese money into New Zealand.
Would it then be accurate to say that free trade deals are anti-competitive?
they are. I always put the word free and free trade in inverted commas because there's nothing free about it at all. It's actually preserving a monopoly position of sort of large corporations. And we've seen very, very recently in this country the way American big business operates when it wants things to get its own way. And the perfect example of that was the behavior of Warner Brothers when they came flying in, sent their executives over here, and whenever it was, October 2010, to sort of heavy New Zealand Actors Union and indeed the New Zealand government, headed by the very same Mr. Key, to give Warner Brothers everything they wanted in relation to continuing to film Peter Jackson's film The Hobbit in New Zealand. They wanted labour laws changed in this country, which the government obligingly did, and they wanted more of a taxpayer subsidy, more money, which also the government obligingly did. I think it's somewhere up around $100 million New Zealand dollars now that is being paid out by the New Zealand government so that Warner Brothers will continue to grace us with their presence, and The Hobbit will be filmed in New Zealand as opposed to being filmed in Romania, which is what the option was, the alternative that was being presented. So that's a perfect illustration of the way American big business operates. There's no pretense of it being a free market or anything like that. In the case of Warner Brothers, they came in and received what in the States is called corporate welfare. They, in fact, are among the biggest bludgers or parasites, welfare parasites, in this country in terms of getting taxpayer money. And they demanded that the laws of New Zealand be changed, the labour laws, to suit their one and particular project. So that is a warning.
What are your thoughts, Murray, on the PACER agreement? Are you aware of the PACER agreement in the Pacific here?
I don't know the details. Yes, there's PICTA and PACER. I can't remember. There's two acronyms there.
The Pacific Agreement on Closer Economic Relations, it's the, sort of our equivalent of the EU, a model being proposed to strengthen trade relations between Pacific nations.
Well, effectively, what the bigger economies, like the US, etc., are doing to us, we sort of, you know, we're the one step down. We're doing the same sort of thing to the smaller economies in our backyard. And so this has been the model, unfortunately, not only in trade matters, but in things like military matters. The previous Australian Prime Minister, John Howard, revelled in the title of being George Bush's deputy sheriff in the South Pacific, and Helen Clark was therefore the sort of the deputy sheriff in terms of New Zealand's intervention in the affairs, internal affairs of not one but several Pacific countries. And so PICTA and PACER and those sort of agreements are sort of a fairly heavy-handed attempt by Australia and New Zealand to sort of force these smaller Pacific countries, smaller economies, into sort of throwing themselves open to New Zealand and Australian businesses. In other words, doing to them what the Americans and the larger countries are doing to us.
Yeah. Well, speaking of what the Americans are doing to us and all of that kind of thing, I think this goes beyond nations here, I think there's a global plan here by these enormous organizations like World Bank, IMF, WTO to implement some description of global economic control grid, more or less, to make sure that sovereign nations basically no longer exist, and if they do exist, it's been so undermined that they wouldn't be able to resist if they tried. And the free trade deals, that's what my opinion is. They're basically just globalist dreams about how you can take out a country's ability to support itself. I mean, in New Zealand, we're an agricultural country, right? We produce more food than we can eat. And yet, our food prices are skyrocketing ridiculously. And recently, a free store has opened up, and it was cleared out within a few hours because there's that many people in this country who can't even afford their food. And it's exactly what globalists want.
I mean, if you ask what is the motivation for the New Zealand government to push for these free trade agreements, the answer in one word is Fonterra. New Zealand government is basically sort of enamored of opening the world market up for Fonterra's sort of dairy products, and that is always presented as the sort of the holy grail of opening up the American market in terms of a free trade agreement. But yeah, just as recently as the weekend, I was reading an article on the paper here about how if Fonterra, for example, gets higher dairy prices, that means that we, for its products overseas, that they put up the prices in New Zealand. There is absolutely no allowance made for the fact that this stuff originates in New Zealand, that New Zealanders have to pay the global market. So really what we should be, the global price, I'm sorry. So what we should really be hoping for is a sort of a crash in sort of what the price in Fonterra gets for its milk and butter and products overseas, because that's the only way that they will put the prices down in this country.
In other words, you're advocating for a war on Fonterrorism.
War on, yes. Well, I've seen Fonterra referred to as spelt in the end with T-E-R-R-O-R, rather than the way it is actually spelt. And I mean, yeah, New Zealand, I mean, it's like the Americans used to say years ago that what was good for General Motors is good for America. I mean, it seems to be the line of both Labor and National governments in this country is what's good for Fonterra is good for New Zealand, which is definitely not necessarily the case at all. In terms of those organisations you mentioned, World Bank, WTO, etc., establishing some sort of corporate blueprint, the answer is yes, to a certain degree. They would want to see sort of the sovereign state undermined and replaced by sort of stateless, accountable to nobody but their own boards of directors corporations. I mentioned before APEC. It's significant that APEC is called the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation. It is not actually an agreement between governments as they see it. It's an organization of economies, which is a complete nonsense. There is no such thing as an economy outside of the structure of a state or a government or a society. But that is the sort of way that and these things date back to the sort of the 70s and the 80s, the sort of the boom years of sort of Thatcherism, Reaganism, and through the 90s into that sort of capitalist triumphalism that followed the sort of collapse of sort of the so-called collapse of communism. So this was sort of things like APEC, WTO, the extreme policies of the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, etc., all sort of and mirrored in this country by the sort of the extreme ideological position of people within the New Zealand Treasury still to this day, all date back to that period of saying that basically we need less state. State is bad, public ownership is bad, what we need is businesses and big business running societies and preferably everything in private ownership as opposed to sort of public ownership. So,
my question to the public,
you're right, there is an all-out assault on sovereignty and as part and parcel of that, an all-out assault on democracy. One of the most important factors of this Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement is that, like all free trade agreements, it's been negotiated in secret. I can't tell you what's been negotiated, what's in the text, because that's not actually been made public. And our elected representatives in Parliament won't get any chance to discuss it, let alone vote on it, until after.
Until after the fact. Oh, don't you just love foreign dictatorship, New Zealand? Don't you just love it? How's that working out for you? You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We'll be right back.
About there's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
That's precisely what it is. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about a little bit of history repeating. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will, broadcasting live from the future, from the sunny slave capital in Auckland, New Zealand, on the very front lines of our fabulous New Zealand dictatorship we call a government. Our very special guest joining us live from Christchurch is Murray Horton from the Campaign Against Foreign Control of Our Fabulous Country, Aotearoa. Welcome back, Murray.
Welcome back, Vinny.
Hey, well, one thing we wanted to get into, because the free trade deals are sort of like the wedge that gets driven into our countries to allow it to be kind of split apart and then facilitate more foreign control, foreign power in our country, which undermines our sovereignty. This I know, but the other side of it is more of a more of news of recent days, is the privatization of state assets. What's your take on John Key's recent move?
Oh, entirely predictable. I mean, and national sort of knee-jerk reaction is always to try to settle for the national parties, to settle sort of state. They subscribe to the view that state ownership is bad and private ownership is good, particularly that owned by their own mates. Key and National, when they were elected in 2008, promised that there wouldn't be any asset sales in their first term of government, which of course expires this year on November the 26th. Key has announced the election date. But now they've sort of put their cards on the table by saying that if re-elected, they will sell off, what is it, 49% of four electricity companies, generating companies, Solid Energy, the coal company, and Air New Zealand, the national airline. So, I mean, our view on that, Kafka, Campaign Against Foreign Control's view on that, is that they're bad moves. I used to work for the railways. I actually spent 14 and a half years working for the railways, and that was the classic example of privatisation gone horribly wrong. I was actually gone when it was privatised in 1993. I was made redundant in 91. But the New Zealand taxpayer had to pick up the tab in 2008 and buy back the railway system of this country after it had been through not one but two sets of foreign owners, firstly Americans and secondly Australians. And
Hold on a second. You're saying that that's what happens when the privatisation goes wrong. Does that imply that any privatisation has ever gone right?
Well, the proponents of privatisation would say, yes, of course, it's a good thing. They would point out to various examples in that, but, I mean, from our point of view, the privatisations, you and I are talking on the phone here, Vinny, Telecom is the perfect illustration of a privatisation that was the complete definitive rip-off in New Zealand. It was privatised, sold off totally in 1990 by Labor government, I think for $4.25 billion within less than 6 years. Its first lot of American owners had actually skimmed off somewhere between $5 and $10 billion in profits that had been shipped overseas. It was essentially a cash cow, and telecom service deteriorated. There was no motivation whatsoever for them to actually spend money on upgrading their system, etc. The last government, the last Labor government, actually put pressure on telecom that if they didn't actually improve their service and their systems, etc., then Labor, the government, would step in and invoke various things and get it done. And so telecom very reluctantly actually started to sort of get their act together. But I mean, they were an example. They were just the company that was sold off, a monopoly position, the national phone company, sold off and turned into a cash cow for initially big American corporations, and it's still substantially an American. The ownership's been diluted, but the ownership is still essentially American shareholders. So that is probably still the biggest example of a privatisation that should never have taken place.
I agree with you there, because in the World Bank documents that were released, it talked about selling big state assets like telecommunications, essentially infrastructure-type assets, and selling it to companies that they themselves are heavily affiliated with. In Telecom's case, this was a large American communications company called Bell Atlantic. And then, of course, you know, like you say, they just basically skim it all off the top and then sell it off to smaller investors to basically be left holding the bag.
Well, I mean, in relation to these announced power privatisations that Key has said, he's stressed, the four power companies, the coal company and the airline, he has said that ownership will be aimed at, quote-unquote, mum and dad New Zealand investors. And that sounds fine in theory, but in actual fact, what happens, and this is not just my theory, this is based on previous precedents, what happens is those mum and dad investors either A, don't want to get into buying shares or can't afford to. A lot of New Zealanders got burnt with the crash of the share market here in 1987. It was one of the stock markets that fell heaviest in the world, and it's never really recovered, actually, to the levels it got in the 1980s. So there's two things. Either mum and dad won't get involved in buying shares at all, or two, they will buy those shares, and then somebody will come along and say, here we are from sort of X corporation from the US or Germany or Australia or wherever, and we'll make you an offer of sort of that you can't refuse, and boom, those shares will be gone, and before you can say sort of told you so, those corporations, the power companies, the coal company in New Zealand will be in the hands of foreign big business. And the government doesn't deny that. That's how the market works. And they're all in favour of markets. So if mum and dad decide to sell out to sort of the first big corporation that comes along and offers to buy their shares, they'll be gone. When power companies in Auckland were sold off to sort of mum and dad investors, when they were issued shares, back in the 90s, big institutional buyers sort of swooped on them fairly quickly and made them an offer they couldn't sort of refuse. And so those mum and dad investors were very swiftly bought out under the when there was a previous round of these privatisations of lines companies and power retailers in the 90s. So privatisation, I mean, effectively what it means is you get a privatisation of profit and a socialisation of losses, which means that you and I, the long-suffering taxpayer, are left to sort of clean up the mess, pick up the pieces, sort things out. Now, this happened with Air New Zealand. Air New Zealand was privatised in the 80s, the sort of the height of sort of Rogernomics in this country, and by 2001 it was basically bankrupt, and the government had to step in, the previous government, Labor government, and buy it back using our money. So, and as I say, that also happened with the railways, or Transrail, as it became. So there's two examples.
If that's the case, Murray, I mean, my assumption is, and I base my life on a lot of assumptions like most of the rest of the public, that the case is now open and shut. Public is much better than private, and we shouldn't be doing any of this at all, unless, of course, we really did want to undermine the country and undermine all its people. But the sheer logic of that statement will be lost on a lot of National Party cultists, because they'll go, all right, where did you do your shopping? And I say, well, I do my shopping at Pack and Save because it's slightly cheaper, and they sell me the same poison food as the rest of the supermarket chains with a slightly better price tag, and they call that competition, and then it's somehow a version of success for the bollocks that they rant about.
The thing that gets me about the public versus private debate, and you've got sort of the left on one side, you know, and the conservatives on one side and the other side supposedly, and you've got this big fake debate that goes on. The thing that gets me is our money isn't public. Okay, our cash is issued from foreign debtors.
Right.
And so how is it that anything can be state owned?
How can anything be state owned?
That's what I want to know. Technically, how can anything be state owned? When our currency system isn't based in the state?
Well, that's a good theoretical question. I mean, there's always been a role in any country in the world, and certainly in the United States, bar none, there's been a role for public ownership of various functions that are deemed to be in the national interest and in the public good, that those functions should be actually held by the state. Even the sort of most right-wing so-called libertarian parties in this country say that there should be a role of the state in things like defence and law and order and justice and things like that.
But they miss the facts. They miss the point, though. Just like you said, these institutions, they privatise profits and socialise losses.
Or that's right.
No more so than the Federal Reserve Bank of America, which actually is privately owned.
Right.
By a handful of banks, about approximately 8 banks, and their private shareholders, they issue the U.S. currency out of an incurred debt to the U.S. government.
Right.
Because they're not a branch of government. And in the same way, we borrow money, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars off the Japanese, off European central banks every year in this country. We don't mint our own currency. And so even if something was, quote, a state-owned asset, it's owned with effectively liquidity owed to someone else.
Well, that's,
so
that's
it's
question
a false, it's a false
question
paradigm. It's not even theoretical.
The question of debt is one that's being used as the excuse by Key for the need to partly privatise these assets that he's identified. And it is a straw man argument, because in actual fact, the debt that he's talking about, most of New Zealand's debt is not sovereign public debt, which has been run down to a reasonably low level, mainly due to the efforts of the previous government operating during a sort of a boom period in the first 10 years of this century. Most of New Zealand's debt is private debt, which is debt owed by New Zealand businesses, etc., and New Zealand banks. And the banks, as we know, in New Zealand are not actually New Zealand-owned banks, with one or two exceptions. They're Australian banks. And that's not really our problem. That's not a problem for you and me as taxpayers as to what Australian-owned banks owe, nor is it a problem what New Zealand businesses owe. But that public and private figure is lumped together by the Prime Minister to justify by saying, well, we have to sell off these, or partly sell off these assets, because we owe too much money. That's essentially nonsense.
What he's done is tried to blame the individual. He's tried to say it's all private sector debt.
That's right.
And that we're angels and we're not borrowing $300 million a week and
right.
We're not doing any of this stuff. But then,
well, exactly.
But then the problem,
they're saying
the problem
you
is
and
the
I,
National Party
you're right,
can't
you're
see
saying
that the National
you
Party
and I are sort
won't
of
see
responsible. I mean, there's a wonderful quote on a book. There was a book that I read years ago, which was praising Roger Douglas and Co. for selling off the forests, which are one of the great, one of the major sort of privatizations and sales overseas of that first wave of, Rogernomics in the 80s and into the early 90s. And Douglas was quoted in this book, which was approving of him, and saying that we, him and his mates in cabinet, we knew that the argument that to sell the forests in order to pay debt was a poor argument economically, but it was a good argument to use politically. In other words, it was a sort of a trick, a lie, to mislead people by saying, look, here we are, we're in debt, we have to sell something. So there's nothing new about that argument.
But
that
going back to your point about the banks before, I mean, a lot of people in this country seem to think that rather than a great Jewish conspiracy, there's some great Australian conspiracy, where all the Australian banks run this country, and it's just some big, kangaroo conspiracy. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely, totally asinine. If anyone looks at the backers behind ANZ Bank or anything else, they'll find Chase Manhattan, they'll find JP Morgan, they'll find all these Rockefeller Rothschild banks, essentially.
Well, I don't subscribe to some sort of conspiracy theory involving banks.
It is our problem.
And I mean, the banks in this country, the four major Australian banks, effectively are in a monopoly situation once again.
But it is our problem. It is our problem if we are indebted to XYZ foreign bank, because whatever money we have in circulation then we owe that amount plus interest. And then that amount of interest is offset as our inflation rate.
Yeah,
it's a problem.
Yeah, and they print the money, but they don't print the interest. So technically, there's never enough money and will conceivably never be enough money to pay off the debt. It means that our country is in perpetual debt forever. Now, I don't know about you, mate, but when somebody is in debt for the rest of their natural life, it seems to me like they're going to be a perfect worker slave because, well, there's nothing else they can do. They have to work for the rest of their life to pay off all that debt, which they're never going to pay off.
This debt... The whole question of international debt was a big issue globally in the 80s and 90s, and some of the so-called third world countries took a rather startling sort of approach to it by simply refusing to pay it. I'm thinking of countries like Argentina and some of the South American countries. They just said to the international lending agencies, we'll stick it. We're not going to pay your debt back. They were contracted by governments that were undemocratically elected, etc., so that's not our problem. The problem of our people is your problem.
What's the difference between a foreign institution inventing a currency and issuing it, and then New Zealand and doing that in a sovereign capacity, and so it's not debt bearing. That's what I'm for. I mean, and that's what we need to be fighting here. Otherwise, we're just boxing shadows a lot of the time, where the things public versus private becomes a false debate.
Yeah, we're moving chairs around on the Titanic.
Well, quite possibly. You're talking about the international economic system. Well, I mean, I would fully agree with you that the root cause of the problems that we're talking about is the economic system of capitalism, and the capitalism that we have at the moment is one variety of capitalism.
Yeah, there's not just one variety of capitalism. It's a lot to do with globalism, which is just, quite frankly, very, very fabulous, isn't it, ladies and gentlemen? You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, and we'll be right back after the break. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, brought to you in proud collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz, our very special Kiwi collaborator who we've been very much enjoying on the show for the duration of the last hour today, is Murray Horton from CAFCA, which is the Campaign Against Foreign Ownership of Aotearoa. Murray, welcome back.
Good to be back, Vinnie.
Hey, Murray, can I just add this? My theory on the government's sale of assets or any government scheme to make money somewhere from public coffers is that they are cornered by international banks into a predicament of needing to make money to pay the ever-expanding interest on the ever-expanding debt. And so that's why I'm for addressing the initial premise and saying, if we had our own currency that wasn't issued out of foreign debt, and we could build some sort of real economy here, that we weren't in negative equity continuously, then the government wouldn't have so much of a premise to need to sell public assets.
Well, it's not like they have much of a premise to sell them in the first place.
They have a huge premise to sell them because our country's been indebted at a rate they cannot repay. And so,
I know what you're saying, but the premise of that happening still doesn't stack up anyway, because selling off your public assets doesn't relieve you of any debt. It just gets you more into debt.
It does short term. Of course, it does. If I have a Ferrari in my garage here, but I'm broke and I can't pay GE money and I can't pay ASB. If I sell that Ferrari 360 for $180,000 and trade me, then I'm going to have some initial capital to get me through the next 6 months, and that's all they care about is getting through the next election term. Well, so I mean, there's the incentive for them.
It doesn't
you're right,
work
that's
out
an
as
incentive,
kind of
but I mean, it's a very short-term solution,
though.
And it's not a solution in the sense that those assets. Yeah. I mean,
well, go ahead, Murray. Sorry.
What I was going to say was there's this issue comes up every few years, and the point is always made by various commentators, not simply by us, that because of the amount of assets that have already been flogged off, there's less and less left to sell. It reminds me of a famous Marx Brothers film, one of the great movies, when they were sort of wanting to get somewhere in a hurry on a train, so they started burning all the carriages on the train and firing them into the sort of the locomotive furnace to make it go faster, and eventually there was no train left. And that strikes me as a very similar situation. We're going to sort of have no locomotive, no train left to get wherever it is we're supposed to be going. That selling things in order to... It's like selling your house to pay the mortgage. You might have paid the mortgage off, but then you don't have a house. So where are you going to live? What are you going to do then? Go and buy another house. And where's the money going to come from to buy the other house?
It's really putting the loco into locomotive, you know?
Exactly my analogy. Many New Zealanders are forced into mortgagee sales. They have to sell their house to pay the bank back, because the bank's on their tail. And it's exactly the same if you expand that. The international banks are on the British government's tail right now. They're having to sell out. They're on the US government's tail, have been forever. They're on our tail. You know, so we're having to sell the house and all the contents and able to pay back the real house, because we won't move away from dependence on them. And that's the problem for New Zealand. But people can't see it, because if we start pointing to the real banks and all of a sudden we're anti-Semites or something.
Well, I don't think it's a question of that. It's purely and simply the international financial system and which large institutions dominate it, etc. But also the emphasis for the moment in this country for privatisation is coming from within the political parties, specifically the National Party, because they're presenting it as an ideological position that it is better for things to be in private ownership than it is to be in state or public ownership. It's a position that they've always held as a party, and indeed Labour adopted that position in the 80s, and they've only partly stepped back from it now, sort of 25 years later. And coming up to this election this year, they've sort of spelt out a position that is indeed a bit different from that held by National, and indeed rather different from the one that they've previously held themselves. So it's not a question of being anti-Semitic or anything like that. It's purely and simply pointing out the realities.
If you explain to people the method of fractional reserve banking, and if you start to point into Lehman Brothers and you start pointing to some of these big banks that run things. I mean, a lot of people think just America runs the world and a few corporations over there. I mean, it's ridiculous. America's in has a huge amount of foreign debt. America's debt has gone up uniformly with money supply over the last 50, 60 years, totally conclusively tied. So America owes these people money. Britain owes these people money. Wait a minute, who are these people? Oh, they reside in a little place in the Westminster, in the city of London, where the Queen has to ask permission to enter. I mean, that's where they are. And if you start pointing to them, then all of a sudden people are going to come up with... I mean, I've heard it, you know, thousands of times. But how would you protect public assets? I mean, what would your strategy be?
To protect public assets, you require a political commitment from the government and the political parties that want to be the government, that in fact they won't sell them, and if necessary, you write that into law. You make that the policy of the country in exactly the same way that New Zealand being nuclear free is protected by law and has become the status quo in this country. You go back, if we were having this conversation 30 years ago, it would be regarded as pie in the sky stuff. If I said, let's make New Zealand nuclear free and it'll happen by law, you would say, well, no, you would need a sort of major change in public opinion, major change in political opinion, and change in the law. All that happened. And since, when is it, 1987, that has been the status quo in this country. Regardless of changes of government, left-wing, right-wing, et cetera, New Zealand is nuclear-free. So that's the way to do it. That presents the model that you simply...
We just need something that binds, regardless of who's elected, binds them to
absolutely.
Some sort of...
Well, in other words, the law. The law, and also backed up by sufficient public opinion, as the nuclear-free thing is, because it united people of both left and right, the National, Labour, all political persuasions, saying that, yes, we want New Zealand to be nuclear-free, and we will not vote for a party or government that reverses that situation. And there have been attempts to reverse the situation in the ensuing quarter century. I mean, as recently as, 2005 election, when Don Brash was the leader of the National Party, he was caught out telling an American delegation that if he was Prime Minister, the nuclear-free law would be, quote, gone by lunchtime the day after he was elected. Well, in fact, it was Brash that was gone by lunchtime, actually. So that is the way to do it. You build up a head of steam with public opinion, which makes it not worth the while of politicians of any party to proceed with selling those things off. It's the same thing that happened last year, when the national government proposed mining in the conservation estate, mining in national parks. This stirred up so many people in this country. There was a march of, 50,000 people down Queen Street in May last year. And so the government, the National Party, backed away because they saw they were buying a fight that they couldn't win. So that's the way to do it.
That's a good place to end it on. I'd like to thank you very much, Murray, for coming on the show with us today. Okay. The ruling parties of our countries are basically just the same rugby team using economic crisis, which they put the country in the position to, as a pretext to use their ideology to change our economic policy instead of facts and evidence. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will, and we'll see you tomorrow.